The Adventures of Batman with Robin Boy Wonder. From the secret Batcave deep beneath Wayne Manor, they roar out to protect life, limb, and property as Batman and Robin. Watch out, villains! Here come Batman and Robin!
Welcome to the Dave Cave Batman podcast, recorded within the Dave Cave itself, which lies beneath, well, it's actually adjacent to Stately Dave Manor. I am your host, J. David Weider, but you can call me Dave, and I am taking you on a journey through the Silver Age comics of Batman and Robin. That's the goal of this podcast. And who am I to take you on this journey? Well, for the ones who are new here, which now that I say that out loud, I realize is everybody technically, well, I do indeed punch dirty turkeys in the face. Now, to give you the basic overview, which I'll expand upon a little bit later, I've been podcasting about comics since 2010. You may know me from such shows as Superman Forever Radio, The New 52 Adventures of Superman, and Superman in the Bronze Age. And I also currently host Dave Does Podcasts, a hodgepodge show over at twotruefreaks.com, which is still going just on a very irregular basis. And again, I'm going to expand upon myself a bit towards the end of the show and my motivations for doing this show. For now, let me talk about something you may have noticed in my podcasting resume. If you made note of the Superman podcasts that I intentionally listed there and you raised an eyebrow, well, I understand that. And Superman is important to me, very important, but for now, I'm here to talk about Batman. And I could be very simplistic here if you wanted me to. In 1939, Detective Comics, the original namesake for DC Comics, making the comics part of that a little redundant, but Detective Comics published its 27th issue, and in that comic was a tale called The Case of the Chemical Syndicate, featuring a new superhero character in a dark bat costume who solved mysteries. I could dive right into that, but by now, the tale of Bruce Wayne watching his parents get gunned down and donning a bat costume to fight crime is familiar to pretty much every person on the planet. And so is the story of his ward, circus acrobat Dick Grayson, whose parents were killed when the criminal element caused them to fall from their trapeze. And since that's so well known, that's why we're not jumping into the Golden Age. But the reason I mention some of this is to talk a little bit about the Silver Age and what the Silver Age is, and why Batman's Silver Age jumping on point is a little bit flexible. Now, for a long time as a Superman fan, I would find myself jealous of Batman's success at times. But for the early stages of Batman's existence, his creative fate was ruled by Superman. See, Superman hit the ground running, and he was heavily, heavily licensed and marketed. He had his own radio show by 1940, the Fleischer cartoons were in theaters in 1941, he had his first serial in 1948, and by that I mean movie serial, and that yielded a sequel in 1950. The Adventures of Superman with George Reeves began airing in 1952, and there were Superman products from bread to 10 figures fighting a tank to crypto ray guns. As hard as it is to imagine, Batman, really by comparison, hadn't made that big of a splash. Successful, yes, in the comic book medium, but he wasn't a superstar in other mediums. Batman had made a guest appearance on Superman's radio show. He had a failed pilot for his own radio show, which I got to listen to, thanks to Hypnagoria, Google Hypnobobs, and the Natural History of the Batman series that was done there. Really, really good series. Batman also had a pair of movie serials in 1943, in 1949, and they sucked. I mean, period. I don't have a way to defend them. The point I'm trying to make in a long-winded, roundabout way is Batman's star was declining while Superman's stock was going up. And despite both these characters surviving this big superhero apocalypse that happened after Seduction of the Innocent, Superman was thriving, Batman was getting by. To take you behind the scenes and to kind of set up the Silver Age, you had Superman editor Mort Weisinger, who by all accounts was a tyrant. He was loud, he was assertive, he was demanding, he mined ideas from sci-fi pulp stories, and he basically had this attitude of throw it up against the wall to see if it sticks. Anything goes. And that led to some very interesting stories for Superman, who is a sci-fi character. I want to root that, and that is important. You can try all kinds of things with Superman because he can really fit into any genre. Batman can too, but not as naturally. Before anybody thinks that's a slight against Batman, it's just a nature of the character. He's a human being versus Superman, who can juggle planets. Having said that, however, Batman's books were edited by a quieter man named Jack Schiff, who was convinced to follow Weisinger's approach to Superman and create interest for the sales of Batman. Basically, do what Superman is doing. So we ended up with multicolored costumes, negative Batman, zebra Batman, we had time travel, we had lots and lots of aliens. We had a space Batman. Batman, which I love those tales. I actually really do, but if you're thinking the Silver Age that we're going to be covering is based on that, let me go ahead and remove that idea from your head. This was a period where Batman was trying to be Superman, so his cast was expanded to emulate the Man of Steel's expanded cast. We had a Batgirl who was not Barbara Gordon, who was a Supergirl analog. We had Ace the Bathound, who took on Krypto's Rin Tin Tin role because dog movies were popular then. And just as Superman was plagued by the imp Mixus Pidalic, Batman faced the Batmite. Now, I'm in a camp where I happen to be a fan of these tales. I'm a fan of Batmite, to be honest with you. But again, this is not our bread and butter here. They're not the solution, they're the problem. Because none of this really helped. So that type of approach is the past, and the past is prologue as we're going to be going forward through our tales. To give you an idea of how much the approach did not work, by 1964, Hot Stuff was outselling Batman. So clearly, something had to be done, something different, some new set of eyes. This is where we talk about editor Julius Schwartz. You've probably heard the name. If the tale of DC Comics was a fairy tale, Julius Schwartz would be a dragon-slaying knight in shining armor. Having worked in the superhero glory days of the Golden Age, before Frederick Wortham made baseless accusations of comics corrupting the youth, Schwartz was experienced. He was a pro. He knew what he was doing, and he worked with this theory that the readership of comics rotated out every 5 years. This is actually a really insightful idea. It's a bit simplistic, I'll admit, but it's not off base. It's certainly not wrong. Now, with that mentality, Julius Schwartz began to develop this theory that characters who had gone by the wayside could be reintroduced to a whole new audience. Everything was fresh. Everything old was new again. You could recycle or renew these, and superheroes could make a return. It just so happened that Schwartz was the editor of an anthology book called Showcase, which was a prime venue to revive one of the Golden Age's more prominent heroes, the Flash.
A scarlet costume ejects from his ring. And in a blur of motion, police scientist Barry Allen becomes the Flash, world's fastest human. The Flash, whose speed enables him to vibrate through solid walls and conquer the barriers of time and space in the pursuit of evildoers. The Flash, Scarlet Speedster for justice.
Schwartz recruited writer Robert Kaniger and artist Carmine Infantino to bring a new twist to an old favorite, with a redesigned costume, a new secret identity, and a strong basis on science. And on July 5th, 1956, Showcase issue number 4 hit stands, revealing a rethought, retooled Flash that kept the core concept, but virtually nothing else. And it was a huge hit. It didn't stop there. In Showcase number 19, space adventurer named Adam Strange revived DC's sci-fi elements. And in Showcase number 22 came the Green Lantern with writer John Broome. Remember that name.
By authority of the mystic guardians of the universe, on the far distant planet Oa, Hal Jordan, test pilot, becomes the Green Lantern, a cosmic crusader whose magical power ring at his bidding accomplishes the impossible. In his continuing fight against interplanetary evil, Green Lantern, guardian of the galaxy.
Much like the Flash, Green Lantern kept the core idea and completely rewrote the other details. Broome was reteamed with Gil Kane, who was the artist for Green Lantern, and DC had another success, and both the Flash and Green Lantern spun out of their initial trial runs in Showcase and into their own titles, which also burned up the charts. DC superheroes were back. And in a masterstroke, Schwartz teamed up the new heroes with some of the stalwarts that had survived the lean years of superhero publications and recreated the Justice Society of America as the Justice League of America. Basically, everything was coming at Milhouse for DC. The superheroes, and specifically the changes implemented by Schwartz and his trusted creative teams, were just burning everything up. The first appearance of the Flash has long been regarded as the first moment of the Silver Age. If it wasn't the first technical moment, Showcase number 4 is the first big boom of the Silver Age, and that's what I stand by, and I'll fight anybody who decides to disagree. So where is Batman's turn? Well, Schwartz and Infantino on the Flash was successful. Schwartz and John Broome on Green Lantern was successful. So DC's big boss decided to give an order to Julius Schwartz. The tale gets a little bit of variation, but essentially it comes down to this. Turn Batman around in 6 months, or Batman is gone. And just like in any line of work, when your boss issues an order, you follow it. It's your job. So I would say Schwartz recruited, but I think it's more like Volin told Infantino to do the art chores on Batman. and John Broome for the writing, which meant being pulled off of projects like Adam Strange for Infantino. Now, this team and the quest to save Batman is where our show enters the picture. Schwartz, Broome, and Infantino weren't happy with their Batman posting, let me just say that up front. They knew virtually nothing about Batman. In fact, they didn't care about Batman, and Infantino was upset about being pulled off of Adam Strange. But again, the boss gives an order. You follow it. And the Bat books were about to receive a soft reboot with Infantino altering Batman's costume for a new look that most will tell you was just an oval around Batman's symbol on his chest. To that end, there's more to this era than a new look. It's an attitude, and even though the Silver Age was already in full swing, this attitude is why Batman truly joins the Silver Age here. Kind of like your parents suddenly getting a computer and being on Facebook. Big, big difference. The Superman family analogs are stripped away. We have no Ace the Bat-Hound, Batwoman, or imps. For good or for ill, because I think imps are a good thing, but what do I know? And Schwartz wasn't going to wipe the slate clean and give Batman a new origin. The slate is sort of subtly wiped down a little bit, with only the new look announcement really signaling a new era. And we have the Carmen Infantino covers, which are a big, big difference, because we're looking at more pop art than anything else. I think the best term to use is continuity by omission. However, there's a stitch to this. Bob Kane, the co-creator of Batman with Bill Finger, I'm not here to argue this, officially by DC Comics, that is the credit. Bob Kane and Bill Finger created Batman. Either way, Bob Kane was still in the picture and he had a very specific contract. He was contractually guaranteed a certain number of pages each year for his studio. So Kane would remain one of the interior creators, no way around it. This meant that Infantino could only do a portion of the interiors and Kane, or Kane's studio, would do the rest, trying faithfully to take on Infantino's more pop art style. It was going to be a tough task to really revive Batman and Robin, because they were on the brink of cancellation by, well, basically everything that's being told. That may be a bit much, but it is basically the word of mouth at that time. But with this group of creators, if there was any team that could save Batman, well, this team would be it. I mean, we've basically got the dream team here. This is like Jordan, Pippen, Magic Johnson going to the Olympics in 92, except it's Infantino, Broome, and more. Anyway, you get the point. So, with a plan and a heavy collaborative spirit, Batman's new look and the new attitude begin with our very first comic to ever be covered on this show, Detective Comics 327, 300 issues after the Batman appeared for the first time in its pages. And this is a May 1964 cover date. As expected, the cover is by Carmine Infantino, and it is a beauty. A three-panel sequence greets us, and it has Robin coming upon an unconscious Batman laying on the ground, face down. The Caped Crusader stirs and comes to, saying that the last thing he remembers was the explosion, and Robin excitedly orders Batman to remove his mask. Quick! And of course, Elongated Man is at the bottom. I'm not going to comment so much on Elongated Man, and I will not be covering his backups, because it's not Bat-related. And once you crack open this cover, you have the story of all stories, or just the story inside this issue, which is The Mystery of the Menacing Mask, as expected, written by John Broome, with pencils by Carmine Infantino, and they're joined by inker Joe Giella. To break this story down for you, politicians and citizens alike are drawing lines in the sand over an area of Gotham City called Gotham Village. On one hand, it's a bohemian, art-infused area with a lot of historical and cultural value. On the other hand, it's equally infested with crime. Millionaire playboy, man's man, ladies man, and man about town, Bruce Wayne and his young ward, Dick Grayson, are touring the area when they are accosted by a young woman. The woman is crying and screaming that she hates Bruce Wayne, and Bruce has no idea why, since he has never seen this woman before in his life. The woman is able to settle down a bit, and she joins Bruce and Dick for some coffee and conversation to try to hash things out, and introduces herself formally as Linda Green, and she kind of explains things a little bit more. Bruce's support of Gotham Village has been affecting her directly since her fiancé, Jimmy, seems to be involved with the area's crime, somehow, someway. Not sure yet, but I'll just point out that yes, that is a plot point. See, Jimmy disappears at night, and the last time that he did, he left a map of Gotham Village behind, with a mysterious X on it, inside of a circle. This triggers a flashback for the dynamic duo to a chase after a thief, just another night in Gotham City, you know? But in his pursuit, Batman runs right into a penthouse apartment where he is knocked out by an explosion. When Robin awakens Batman, there is an encircled X on his mask, and the same emblem on Robin's forehead. The symbols both vanish, and Batman is able to later deduce that it is a phosphorus isotope, sold by the Rare Chemical Company in Gotham Village, and that trail leads to the home of one Frank Fenton. Sure enough, Fenton is the robber from earlier, but when Batman and Robin try to nab Fenton, he's able to render them completely motionless with only a word and escape with the loot from his robbery. Later, back at the Batcave, Batman concocts a plan to foil Frank Fenton, with a risky plot that led Bruce and Dick to Gotham Village, and back to the coffee shop in the present where Linda Green spots her fiancé. And her fiancé Jimmy is just walking down the streets of Gotham Village, unaware of Linda or that he has now caught the attention of Batman and Robin, the Boy Wonder. Bruce and Dick tell Linda to sit tight as they go after her fiancé Jimmy, but this time in costume as Batman and Robin. They trail Jimmy to a small house where he vanishes, but Batman is able to find a secret passage to an enormous underground cave. The cave is a criminal sanctuary, a place for low lives to hide while basically waiting out the law. And our good buddy Frank Fenton just happens to be there looking for refuge. But Frank and the head of the refuge, Smiler, are taking a tour and Frank is explaining why he should get a discount since he has protection against Batman and Robin. Almost on cue, the Caped Crusaders show up and seem to fall under Fenton's powers, but this is a ruse to suss out Smiler so they can take down the secret criminal hideaway. Batman and Robin go into action, fighting Fenton and the criminal element and defeating them all to put Smiler in custody. But Batman deduces that something isn't right with Smiler and peels off a mask to reveal Roland Meacham, a staunch advocate for saving Gotham Village. And he would have gotten away with it if not for that Batman and Robin. In the end, it's revealed that Batman was able to block Fenton's beams with a lead-lined cowl and piece of flesh-colored tape on Robin's forehead, and it's revealed that Jimmy was trying to weed out the criminals in Gotham Village, and now, with Meacham out of the picture, Gotham Village is no longer under attack. Jimmy and Linda can live happily ever after in Gotham Village thanks to the heroics of Batman and Robin, the Boy Wonder. And that is the breakdown of Detective Comics number 327. To discuss this issue in depth, I'm going to come right back after this podcast promo for Batman Nightcast.
Holy hysterics! Batman will be back before you can bat your eyes!
Batman Nightcast, a thrilling new podcast from the Fire and Water Podcast Network, hosted by Ryan Daly
and Chris Franklin. Nightcast chronicles the Caped Crusaders' adventures in Batman and Detective Comics after Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Highlights from this legendary era include
Batman number 400,
Legends,
Mike Barr and Alan Davis,
Batman Year 1,
Batman Year 2,
Max Allen Collins, the new Jason Todd, Millennium?
You're not doing this right, let me take over. Alan Grant and Norm Breyfogle!
Alan Grant from Jurassic Park?
Did you hear me say Norm freaking Breyfogle?
Oh yeah!
Son of the Demon!
The Killing Joke!
A Death in the Family!
Batman Year 3!
A Lonely Place of Dying!
Alan Grant, Alan Davis, Max Allen Collins. Why are there so many people named Alan from this era of Batman?
The Rise of Tim Drake!
Legends of the Dark Knight!
And that's just up until 1989.
Did anything exciting happen with Batman after that?
You'll have to tune in to find out!
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Find it on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Oh, we forgot to mention your favorite issue, when Batman fires Dick Grayson.
You want to find another co-host?
Alright, so we are back from break, and of course, check out Batman Nightcast, hosted by Ryan Daly and Chris Franklin. That's over at the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Now, to start with the outside of the book, the cover. As you may have noticed in my description, it's not a single image. It is actually a semi-story in itself, three panels. Which is an effective teaser because, well, we want to know what the heck's up with Batman's forehead. Why is Robin telling him to take off his mask? But the thing about that is, even though we have this image touting Batman's new look, this big, brand, bold new look, we don't see it. So not only are we intrigued by Robin and the concept of him telling Batman to take off his mask, we're also intrigued by what exactly is Batman's new look. And what also struck me was the fact that there's actually quite a bit of negative space here. I mean, yes, you have elongated man on the bottom, but that's still within negative space. So the white actually makes this cover stand out. I don't know what it would look like on comic racks back in the day, but it stands out when you're looking at something like DCIndexes.com, Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics. However, once you open the cover, you kind of have a frontispiece, which, in my opinion, is an art form in and of itself, because it works much like a cover. It has to sensationalize and synopsize the issue on a single page or image. And usually it's not as big as the cover. It doesn't have the colors to grab you. It's just kind of the beginning of the story. And with this one, Infantino really does a great job because while we have the cover showing that sequence with Robin telling a revived Batman to remove his mask, we have something far more interesting here. This front piece actually shows Batman and Robin paralyzed by the power of Frank Fenton, which gets my attention a lot more because I want to know more about why that's happening. It's a little sci-fi, but it's not over-the-top sci-fi. One of the things that the Batcave companion pointed out about this, and I hadn't noticed it on my first read-through, was that you no longer have this big block of expository text on the frontispiece. Normally there'd just be this unread chunk of text, and it would tell you everything you need to know so you can jump right in. But with this streamlined, it indicates to me that Schwartz was understanding that the audience is both aware of who Batman and Robin are, so we can streamline that, but he also respects their intelligence to not say some of the redundant things that you might find in those texts. Both the cover and the frontispiece made me want to go forward, so they did their jobs, they did it in an exemplary fashion. We open to Gotham Village, which is basically Greenwich Village. I'd love to just track some of the neighborhoods and buildings of Gotham City that we're never ever going to see again. And in this case, we don't see Gotham Village again, which is a shame because it is gorgeous. Now, in an interview I was reading in the Batcave Companion, yes, that book again, Infantino was talking about in that interview that he loved architecture. That was one of the things he loved to draw. And admittedly, when you think about Gotham City, at least at this vintage, Gotham wasn't going to be quite as exciting as some of the alien environments in Adam Strange. So Infantino really decided to bring up a notch to the sort of generic-looking city you normally saw and make something with personality. And Gotham Village definitely has that. Gotham Village looks like the 1960s movement had a one-night stand with the current hipster movement and birthed some buildings and an attitude. It's extremely detailed, and I really want to applaud Infantino because he really went all in. Not only in the structures of the buildings, but there are beatniks hanging out at cafes, they're painting, they're playing music. It's a bohemian dream, and it feels real, it feels alive, because I actually believe that I can walk through this neighborhood and have my taste criticized by being too mainstream, because it does feel like hipster village. But to focus back here on Gotham Village, we find Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson taking this stroll in what is being touted as a crime-ridden neighborhood. Which, to me, is Bruce Wayne saying, "Hi, I'm an easy mugging target. Note the bullseye, right here, right here. Oh, take the kid, too. We got a kid. Easy target." I mean, it's not like Bruce Wayne's face isn't known. In fact, he gets recognized pretty quickly. And we have Linda. I mean, this is just a crying woman coming up to Bruce, telling him how much she hates him. And suddenly, he's trying to remember every bad date he's been on. I was like, was it Lisa? Was her name Lisa? Linda? You? Me? You? I think it would be hilarious if it turned out that Linda Green actually just always walked around in hysterics like that, like some Shia LaBeouf performance art, and she's kind of a local Gotham Village celebrity. But, you know, as we move forward, they do manage to calm her down. I don't know if they're doing the Chris Rock shaking her type of thing, but they calm her down and they go to the neighboring table and they go into this deep conversation. Also in deep conversation are the beatniks at the neighboring table, sharing the tale of Large Marge, I assume.
On this very night, 10 years ago, along the same stretch of road, in a dense fog, just like this, I saw the worst accident I ever seen.
And Linda shows Bruce and Dick this map of Gotham Village. And I couldn't help it. I wanted to, but I couldn't help it that, you know, one of the main marks is an X inside of a circle. And I just can't help but picture that Xavier and his mutant students are getting run out of Gotham Village, you know? And what if this is the area of town where the mutants from The Dark Knight Returns started developing? Like you had protests and things like that? Which makes the rubber bullets a bit more ironic, given that 60s protests were pretty intense. But somehow through this Gotham Village, you have hipsters and vigilantes coming up through the same channels. It's beautiful, actually. And then we go into the flashback where Batman is pursuing Fenton and he gets caught by surprise by an explosion. He's caught by surprise, people. It's kind of refreshing in today's Bat-God environment. I mean, I love Batman, clearly, but anytime I hear the argument, if Batman has time to prepare, he can do this. I'm sorry, but sometimes he can just underestimate a scenario. He is a human being. He's peak human, but human. Now, while that was refreshing and I can see it, there's this that I can't fully digest. Batman is in this penthouse apartment where the gym thief was just present and where he had set up trap, and Batman whips off his mask at Robin's request. Far be it for me to question the Batman, but I'm thinking you might be visible. You're on the enemy's turf and you're just kind of popping off the mask. I believe that could have waited. Because bear in mind, Fenton planned this. This was a trap set up ahead of time. He set the trap, he put Batman and Robin where he needed them, and now they're just taking off their disguises. But as we learn through the story, we have isotopes of phosphorus. Those are fancy. There's actually apparently 23 of these, and they're mostly used for nuclear medicine. Now, there's no reason to believe that the logic of the story being that this phosphorus can affect motor skills thanks to a certain frequency of beams, There's no reason to buy all the way into that, I will admit this. And yet there's just enough pseudoscience where I can allow it to transpire. Okay, he has a little bit of control. Okay, fair enough. I'll go with you for the story because, you know, it is what it is. If you don't accept that, this whole story falls apart. And I say that to say this, because something exciting happens in this story, people. We have Batman, the world's greatest detective, doing detective work, following logic and reason and the evidence to solve a problem. That's right, he's using his wits, he's using what's in front of him rather than just knowing and being six steps ahead of everybody at any given time. It's beautiful to me, and it's logical, and it's nice that the isotope is so rare that they can narrow it down to this rare chemical company. Little on the nose with the title, but it's like Virchicon in Austin Powers.
Welcome to Virchicon, company of the future. Virchicon is a leading manufacturer of many items you can find right in your very own home. We make steel, petroleum products, and volatile chemicals.
And then under normal circumstances, that detective work would lead to Fenton, and they would be able to arrest him, but even Robin calls it and says, this is too easy. Sure enough, when they get there, Fenton flips the switch and plays his hand. The funniest part to me, and I have to point this out, is when our heroes arrive, Fenton sees them coming through the door. It's the dynamic duo, and they're coming after him. And he's casual, like Tommy Wiseau in the room. Oh, hi, Batman. And it's fantastic. This whole sequence cracks me up because Fenton takes his time packing up his loot and he's flaunting it. I mean, he really kind of takes the high road because A, he doesn't kill them, and B, he could really be having more fun. You know, put some rouge on them, some lipstick on the Cape Crusaders, give him a little bit of a Dolly Parton makeover, that kind of thing, but he takes the high road. And to that, there's actually a bit of a harsh defeat to this. It's a blow to Batman and Robin's pride. And again, Fenton could have killed them, but later Batman points out that Fenton's just not a killer. Don't get me wrong, he's not Mr. Morals, he's still a thief, but he's not a murderer. But yet, he can still just rub this in, man. I mean, he can really, really rub it in, and does. And we kind of come back to the Batcave, which in this instance feels like a cave with furniture and nothing more. Now, this is relevant to about two episodes from now, because we are going to see some upgrades to the Batcave, but we have no giant penny, no giant playing card, no dinosaur. And yes, Batman has put the clues together. You know, he's figured out, okay, there's something with this phosphorus that is affecting our motor skills, and he's come up with a scenario, a plan, with some real risks, because it may not work. But he's again, followed the evidence and what we have, and come up with a potential solution. Rather than having a solution no matter how unlikely the scenario is. I mean, the world could be yelling, zombie kittens are eating Selena Gomez's soul like Dementors from Harry Potter, and Batman would have a special batarang for that very purpose. No, with this, in this instance, it's trial and error on Batman's part. And you know, just to kind of comment on the art a little bit as we're talking about this, Fenton just looks slimy. I mean, he's like the guy that puts the mirrors on the top of his shoes. He has a really animated look to him, and I really like him. I love that Infantino puts work into what is apparently just a one-off villain with no real continuing plot line or anything of that nature. And to the new look, I told you I was going to talk about this. Here is probably a good enough spot. Robin is redone. He's small, so he's still childlike, but his muscles are really tight. They're very compressed. It's still an acrobat's body, but it's very small, undeveloped, which sounds a bit creepy, I know, but he looks like he could actually be 12 years old and still ripped, but not in the same way that a 27-year-old would be ripped. Basically, Robin's still on the safe side of puberty. The cave, the Batcave, we have this shot of both Batman and Robin in this candlelight, which, you know, I just want to point this out while I'm here. It invokes to me the pledges that both of these characters have made during their origin stories. Batman's origin story in Detective Comics number 33, Robin's in Detective 38. These are pledges, these are oaths. Neither of these people have made these oaths lightly or without some sort of realization of the consequences to their actions, that there would be sacrifices and potential dangers along the way. And a lot of times when people speak of the Silver Age, especially the Silver Age Batman, I feel like this era gets overlooked for not being dark or brooding. For, you know, some people would say it's campy. And admittedly, it's not, to borrow a bit from Tom Paneris's Taking Flight, it's not this guy.
Darkness!
The main thing is, with a character like Batman, though, you can't escape the darkness. It's inherent in the very core concept, because no matter which way you slice it, this is a man who is waging a war, waging a lifestyle, let's use that word, based on the death of his parents. He is sacrificing a quote-unquote normal life to take the law into his own hands and make sure that justice is served and that the innocent are protected. Which, noble or tortured, it's still coming from a dark source. We don't necessarily need to be hit over the head every 10 minutes with a reminder that, you know, we have dead parents on the table and everything is dark and everybody's bad. So I do want to point that out. I also want to come back to the art again. I'm sorry, I kind of got distracted there, but Infantino's Batman is built, but he's not a roided out brick wall. One of the things you would see prior to this was Batman was very squared in a lot of ways. His angles were very tight. He was very broad, less realistic. Here he's sleeker, he's less exaggerated, and there are more curves to his look. Everything kind of fits together more naturally. And even though that he has more of a superhero look, I think this is the next step to bringing darkness back to the design of Batman, which is something Neil Adams will pretty much stick a fork in. And sorry about that note within a note. It was just a thought process as I was talking about the design. But it was something I definitely wanted to address. So the new look is more sleek, more realistic, without being extremely photo real. And to kind of pick up the story here, we go to the second half here, the second part. Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson go after James Jimmy Packer, but Jimmy meets Batman and Robin, not Bruce and Dick. Bearing that in mind. So it looks like Bruce and Dick told Linda they were going to go meet with Jimmy and then took off. Not to mention, you know, making connections to the secret identities, which nobody does. Now we're leaving that ornate part of Gotham Village and going to the residential area, which looks less dynamic and eye-popping, but more true to life. We have broken fences, decayed rooftops on houses, kind of a skid row. And I think it's kind of cool that Batman is following this and finds this. Basically, the way they find the secret entrances, there are fingerprints in the dust. And I assume there are a lot of entrances to this area, sub-Gotham Village as it's called, and this was just one of the more overlooked entrances, maybe forgotten, which leads to the downfall. They failed to secure the entrance, and lo and behold, that's the way sub-Gotham Village drops. And that's what the refuge is called, sub-Gotham Village, which is actually, believe it or not, extremely plausible. In Missouri, we have Merrimack Caverns, which is more well-known for where Jesse James hid, but this is just a huge chamber after chamber of caves. At one point, there were underground billboards there, a mirror room, so it's actually very plausible that a place like this could exist, and I think it's a genius idea. You look around here, this refuge, sub-Gotham Village, it has a pool table, there's a movie theater, a place to get fake passports, and this is all for a 50% cut. Genius! I mean, can you picture the brochures? It would have me sold. I'd even do the timeshare tour just to get to this place. Now, while I would be grateful, Fenton is trying to play his trump card, his Batman and Robin insurance, which he could just make a career on this alone, or sell the isotope technology to a hostile nation, and the Cold War just changed. But all of this ends up with Batman and Robin looking like they're in a terrible, terrible scenario. They're frozen in this den of criminals, and you think, could this be the end of the dynamic duo? And of course not, it's a ruse. Batman has gambled that lining his cowl with lead would block Fenton's beams, and it works. But Batman gambled. He won, but he gambled. Not only that, he did a Kenny Rogers and waited to know when to hold him and know when to fold him. And he waited till he could not only take in the small fish of Fenton, but take down the refuge and take in Smiler. Batman gambled big, he won big, and he's smart. He's the smartest guy in the room, without being too smart. And once we go to the action, I realize this is where Infantino is in his element. He specializes in action. He specializes in motion. Look at his flash work. It's all about motion. And when Batman and Robin finally move into action, Carmen is in top form. Batman does this amazing run-by-punch, which is straight-up proof that these people were not aware that Batman lives what we know as the thug life. At one point, Batman slides into some armed crooks because essentially his back is against the wall. And when Batman has that, he doesn't have all these expertise. He has to do what he has to do. He doesn't use Tai Chi or ninjutsu. He uses Joe DiMaggio. And this comes to the point where everybody lost their mind, apparently, because Batman holds a gun for two panels, which caused a huge, huge uproar because Batman doesn't use guns. And see, in my original reading, I completely misread it. I thought he had disarmed one of the criminals and may actually be holding the gun, but he may actually mean business. It's up for interpretation. I think that was more circumstance. I still lean towards the fact that he just disarmed somebody and he still got it in his hand, but your mileage may vary, and I don't think he shot at anybody, so right there you gotta be psyched. Batman hasn't crossed over into Dirty Harry territory just yet. And then Smiler is unmasked Scooby-Doo style. Roland Meacham, who owns sub-Gotham Village, the haunted criminal refuge, is revealed to be Smiler. Let's be honest here, the Roland Meacham angle wasn't needed. why would he wear a disguise around the criminals and show his real face amongst the politicians unless there's some sort of political commentary there? Read into it what you will. But I think it was just unnecessary, unneeded. It didn't add anything to the story, and the story was fine without it. Now, what is a good happy ending is that Jimmy ends up being the good guy, and he gets reunited with Linda. It's corny, I will give you that, that this couple finally gets to live happily ever after. But it also gives us a human face for Batman to fight for, and for us to care for. And as much as I like the idea of Gotham Village and the Underground Refuge, we never see them again. Because how cool would it be to have Batman set up something like a second Batcave? So should he ever move into the heart of Gotham City away from Wayne Manor, he would have a refuge, a headquarters. But, of course, we all know Batman would never do that. He'd never live in a penthouse on the top of Wayne Foundation, would he? This is where Dave stares at the camera. Here's what I like about this story, is that you didn't have Batman trying on all kinds of different colored costumes. We technically had no bat gadgets. We had some scientific equipment, a lead shield, but nothing bat-oriented, not even a batarang. It doesn't feel like we've hit a hard stop and started this whole new era. It's actually a smoother reboot. The oval is the most notable obvious change, but there's more subtle returns to detective modes, a more focused tone to the story, and it starts trying to change its aesthetic. It's not grounded or gritty, it's not ultra-realistic, but the building blocks are there for Batman that we know today. No villains, just detective work, relying on his wits, his fists, and Robin. Now, as for Fenton, in my head, he went off to do his time, he earned a chemical engineering degree that he put to good use when he got released from prison, and went on to create Ecto Cooler. Jimmy and Linda married in the fall of 64 and opened a cheese shop in Gotham Village. Their children would eventually inherit the cheese store and run it into the ground around 1986. And Batman and Robin continued to fight crime and corruption in Gotham City, becoming legends. Legends that this podcast will be covering. To kind of start bringing this show in for the close for this very first episode, I promised I would tell you a little bit about the origins of the show. Now, normally episodes won't be this long, and I want to keep this fairly brief. But, you know, the great question is, how does someone begin their podcasting career with Superman and end up with a Batman show? The truth is, my love for Batman and Superman go back to the exact same origin points. For me, it really began in the 1980s, the very early 80s, with Bozo the Clown, who would show the Filmation Superman and Batman cartoon shorts in equal measure. And so I was exposed to them equally through that and Super Friends. In 1984, for my birthday, I got the Superpowers figures of both Batman and Superman together. Once again, they're neck and neck. That Christmas, I got the Fisher-Price books and tapes, Superman from Krypton to Metropolis, which formed a lot of my education about Superman. I also got the Batman and Robin in the Case of the Laughing Sphinx. So once again, these two are neck and neck. In 1986, to tell you a little secret that I don't think I've ever said on air, my first short story in second grade was a Batman story, which featured Batman at the end racing against time, a race that Batman lost. That's right, I wrote a story where Batman lost. Batman failed. Now, of course, where rubber hits the road with Batman was 1989 to 1999, where we had Batmania, the Tim Burton movie, the Toy Biz Batman, the Dark Knight collection, which I loved, Batman Returns toys, and one day I'm going to tell you about my awesome fanfic idea from 1991 involving those toys. We also had Batman the Animated Series through that period, which I would rush home to watch. Now, somewhere along the way, though, I became a Superman apologist to copyright Michael Bailey. I grew to love Superman again, and I grew over time, because of that love, to become defensive, and I developed this very big chip on my shoulder. It became exhausting, because anywhere I went, if I mentioned that I liked Superman, or, oddly enough, Captain America, any other character, I would be regaled with the reasons that somebody loved Batman, which got a little bit old, because A, they're assuming that I don't love Batman, B, they're wanting to argue with me for no real reason, and C, when out in the public, when being accosted like that, usually the arguments for Batman are really bad arguments, with very little logic. So I had a chip over my shoulder for a long time, and I moved away from my Batman fandom. And people, let me tell you this, if your argument is anybody could be Batman and that's his appeal, if anybody could be Batman, somebody would be. I don't want to watch him brood all the time. I don't want him to know everything two steps ahead of everybody. I don't want him living like a normal person and folding laundry or balancing his checkbook. I want something special. So I developed this chip on my shoulder, and come 2015, summer, I decided that, you know, my Batman wore blue and gray, and that I needed to reconnect with this fandom. And I started that path with my Tales of the Batman Len Wein volume, which I love and recommend, and then I dove into the showcase, and I found myself in a place of joy, and I wanted to share that joy, which was when this podcast was born, essentially. Now, even after writing and recording some bits, I decided there wasn't really an audience for that show, and I put it to the side for some time, even after all the planning, etc. But lo and behold, just about the time I decided to take a look at releasing this show as part of Dave Does Podcasts, Bob Fisher, current host of Superman Forever Radio, offhandedly mentioned that there was some interest, that somebody out there was looking for a Batman podcast set in the Silver Age, and I'm like, I'm the guy for that. And since most of the legwork had been done, and since I had the basic idea set up, well, here we are. It comes down to this. We live in a very negative age, and my goal is to project some of the simple, unfiltered joy and fun of these comics into the world. I'm not going to be melodramatic and think this show is a light in the darkness, but it is an escape. It's a place of safety and positivity and fun. And as cheesy as that sounds, that's what we're here for. Now, since this is a new show, I've been set up for a few weeks now since the trailer released onto the world, and I want to give a few shoutouts to some of the early adopters to the Facebook page. Because listening to Batman Nightcast and Secret Origins podcast, I noticed one thing Ryan Daly does that I appreciate is give shoutouts and appreciation to listeners, and I want to make sure I keep up with that. So shoutouts go out to Mike Moran, Michael Scudurlo, Andrew Leyland, Gene Hendricks, Dave McElvenny, Mike Zumo, Michael Bailey, Robert Ward, Ryan Daly, Charlie Niemeyer, Pat Simpson, Billy Locke, Randy Dunn, and Matt Price, and Gord Tolton. Thank you all for becoming my initial cave dwellers, which I will call my listeners, because you're dwelling in the Dave Cave. You get it, you get it. But you all liked the Facebook page, sight unseen, having not heard anything but the trailer, so I appreciate that. And over on the Twitter, I had likes or retweets from Jason Sandberg, Mark Wiggins, Number One, Justice's First Dawn, Mick Ginger, Jeffrey Brown, Xenozoic Xenophiles, which is Darren and Ruth Sutherland's show about Cadillacs and dinosaurs, Eric Mannix, and Coffee and Comics blog. So guys, I really want to say thank you. Hold on, this bat phone should not be working. You haven't even heard the episode yet. I can't get feedback through the bat phone. Just a second, let me see what they need. Hello? Yes, this is he. Yes, Detective Comics 327, first look at the new look Batman. No? No? But are you sure about that? Okay, let me see. Let me take a look. Oh, no. I will get that rectified right away. Thank you. Well, now, this is awkward. Because I have just been informed that there has been a huge error in this episode. In fact, the whole episode is kind of an error in and of itself. It turns out that I am completely wrong. Detective Comics number 327, despite what's on the cover, is not the first appearance of the new look Batman. But you'll have to turn in next time to the thrilling answer as to which comic book it was that did feature it. Holy twist ending, everybody. That's going to be next time. For now, here's Batman himself to sign off the episode. Thank you so much for joining.
And until we meet again, boys and girls, know that wherever evil lurks, in all its myriad forms, I'll be there with the hammers of justice to fight for decency and defend the innocent. Good night.
The Dave Cave Batman Podcast is a J. David Weider production and is made for entertainment purposes only. It does not draw profit from the material discussed. Batman, Robin, and all related characters are copyright DC Comics, all rights reserved. All opinions are those of the host and do not reflect the views of any other individual, entity, or organization. All music and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes only, and the copyrights lie with the copyright holders. No infringement is intended. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time.